Hi, everybody. It's Brian Greene from the Commercial Break Podcast. It's likely you've heard of the show if you're directly related to me or you follow our MySpace page. But I'm not here to talk to those three listeners. I'm here to appeal to people who haven't heard the show. Along with my co-host, Kristen Joy Hoadley, we're taking a deeper look at the topics that are affecting our youth today. Like, who are the people who are dating ghosts? Where did all these pickup artists come from? And why doesn't my preacher have a nicer private jet? We understand that these are the issues you really want to get to the bottom of. The Commercial Break is now available on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.
Lance Reisland joins us right now on the show on the North Homestead Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. He's a football guy. He joins us from Cleveland.com. He's a special to Cleveland.com, breaks down all the film. You see him on Spectrum as well, covering the high school football games, an analyst there. And he joins us right now. Lance, good morning to you.
Hey, good morning, guys. Thanks for having me.
We're glad to have you. Now, I'm going to get to Kenny Pickett and a couple other things here in just a moment. But could one position group be better than we think? Could that be the wide receiver position group? You had a very interesting post yesterday where Luke Fleurier, that's how you say his last name, right? I don't want to be disrespectful to the young man, is being compared to Julian Edelman. Explain.
Well, you know, he's not Julian Edelman, right? But what the Browns lack is Browns lack that easy yards guy. And I've said it for years, the Browns have to go right now, since Kevin Stefanski has actually been here, they have to go 10 to 12 plays every single time. And you constantly hear they're undisciplined last year. And really, it's not being undisciplined on offense. It's that you're on the field too long. And if you have to go 10 to 12 plays, 10, 15 plays, regardless of what level you are, it's hard not to have mistakes. It's hard not to have defenses make plays against you. So they need an easy yards guy. Now, he's a guy that can work against safeties. He's a guy that can work against linebackers. He's sudden. He's switchy. He's kind of got an edge to him. He reminds you, it's the traits, right? It's the ability to work inside. It's his ability to run those option routes, the ability to be extended run game so you don't have to block everybody in the run game. You can throw some RPOs to him. He can help you on special teams. He can also help you in getting ready for those slot receivers that you're going to see this year, the St. Browns, I think people like that. So there's things that he can do. With the lack of depth the Browns have at receiver and the lack of depth they have with what his skill set is, I think he's a guy who has a chance to make the team because he brings an element of sudden and twitchiness. And Browns got to win first down, and they got to stay out of those second, third long situations to protect that quarterback, whoever that may be.
Had they had that in theory with any of the other wide receivers they had attempted to take? Granted, again, they're always taking receivers, you know, in the third round, the fourth round, and beyond. But was there anybody else they had maybe thought over the years that could fill the role you're talking about?
Well, if you look back, Jarvis Landry is a guy that was really good at that, right? He was undersized, wasn't outright straight line speed, but he could work in the slot. He had enough speed, football speed, I like to say. He did a lot of really good things. The Browns receiver wise kind of reminds me, they have like a body type they like, right? Long arms. They've done really good. You know, Seth Tillman, I think, can be really good. I am high on him if he can stay healthy. That body type, right? The guy who's an outside one guy can stretch it vertically, run the comebacks, the digs, things like that. But they have not had a lot of those guys inside who are good in a phone booth, right? Guys who can beat you in area, work out against a linebacker, really good at understanding coverage and leverage and angles and things like that. That's something they haven't had. They've had some really good outside guys, even Donovan Peoples-Jones. If you look at that body type, vertical guy, not always good in a small space. That's what really helps a quarterback, right? Guys who can find areas. You don't have to do a lot. You don't have to throw it a long way. The coverage underneath is easier to read sometimes than the coverage over the top. So no, they haven't had a lot of guys. Last guy that I think they had was Jarvis Landry, who was very, very good at it.
Do you think it matters in that regard, who the quarterback is for how good any of the young receivers can be? Like, obviously, the last few years, they were building around an offense that was supposed to be compatible with a very different type of quarterback in Deshaun Watson. Now they've kind of gone in another direction, although they've got four different quarterbacks to choose from now. Do you think that matters, or do you think these guys can stand out at wide receiver regardless of who is the signal caller?
Well, you know, the receiver position is different now, right? Because you're not in 11 personnel as much as you've been, right? You're not a spread team. You're not asking those offensive line to drop back and pass protect with a true quarterback in the pocket. Now you're involving the run game in the pass game, which means you're going to do a lot of play action. Play action really helps those offensive linemen because those defensive linemen have to kind of respect the run first. So the receiver position, you know, don't have to be as deep or as talented. As long as you have some guys who can go over the top, guys can sit in zone, because if you can win on first down and run the ball, you dictate. So if you get the second and five, you can dictate what the defense has in the game. Then you get less people covering. Then you get less underneath coverage. Then you can take play action shots over the top. You kind of simplify it for the quarterback if you can win on first down and run the ball and be physical. Because remember, that defense has to work on physicality all week. We're playing the Browns. If you think about a couple years ago with Chubb, we're playing the Browns. We've got to work on that physicality. We've got to work against power and counter and pin and pull. You're not worried so much about the pass game. When you're facing Deshaun Watson, the theory was we got to cover the pass, right? And run game is the quarterback's best friend. It's cliche, but it's really true. And it can really help a young quarterback or a transitioning quarterback if you can win on first down and be in control on second and third down.
Run game has struggled over the last couple of years. Do you have to have a respected run game for play action to really work?
You know, it's interesting, right? You got to be committed to the run. And sometimes you will be successful with it, but sometimes you face guys you can't block. But it's the theory of what is that? For me, it's always about what is the other team working at? And even at the high school level, there's two work days, right? So for us in high school, we really worked hard and hit each other on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. What do we want the defense to work on? So whether we're running the ball successfully or not, what are they trying to stop? And whether they say to you, we're going to stop the run, and they do stop the run, that's still setting up your play action. So obviously you got to have some success in the run game, but more importantly, you got to be committed to your identity. You got to say, you know, we're going to run the ball. If you look back, you know, everybody talks about, you know, we got to get less defenders in the box. There was times when Browns didn't care what you did. You put 8-9 in the box, they didn't care. They're going to run it at you. And that's an identity, and that's the identity that a defensive coordinator has to kind of work on during the week. So it's more of, we're going to run it no matter what you do, and that's what the defense is working on, and that will help set up play action. So success is kind of overrated in terms of, we got to make sure that this is our identity and the defense is working on that during the week.
It's funny you said that, because that kind of epitomized, Kyle Shanahan loved it when he saw 9 guys, 10 guys in the box, because those all had home run capabilities. And I felt like that was the case too with Nick Chubb. You'd have all these guys that were ganged up at the line. And so, speaking about Chubb, obviously they're trying to fill his position through the draft. They went and got Judkins from Ohio State, 36 overall. And then a little bit later on, 126, Dylan Sampson. Kind of compare and contrast those guys and their home run hitting capabilities.
Well, a lot of people have said they're, you know, like thunder and lightning. I really don't see him like that. I think they're both really well-rounded backs. Judkins, to me, I had him a little bit underrated after seeing him at camp in terms of his physical body. He's a thick kid who can really help those guys, like I said, win on first down. Sampson's the same thing. Now, Judkins, I always like to say with backs, you know, Judkins is a guy who runs with his hair on fire, right? So you're going to have to block it because he's coming. Where Sampson's a little bit more patient. So if you think about a gap scheme where everybody has a simple rule and you just get downhill, Judkins is going to be really, really good at power, counter, where Sampson's kind of an inside zone, which is very Stefanski-like, right, where you got to be patient and let those linemen work. I also think they've included another back, and people, what does that mean? Well, Jerome Ford now goes back to what I think he can be really good at, right? He's a third down back. He pass protects very well. He's a home run hitter. If you can get him on a screen, get him on a swing, isolate him like Stefanski likes to do in empty. So they've now, not only they got two backs that kind of fit the scheme on first and second down, they've allowed Jerome Ford to do what he does best. So I think Judkins, for me, Sampson's very good, but for me, Judkins is a guy, because of his heaviness, he gets them, allows them to win on first down, which is going to be key for both sides of the ball for the Browns to have success this fall.
Lance Reisland joining us on the show, special to Cleveland.com, former coach. You see him on Spectrum. I've been telling people I was going to ask you this all morning, so here it goes. Are we sleeping on Kenny Pickett?
Well, for me, the quarterback situation is always funny. I will say this without question. It does not matter until the pads go on. It does not matter until you get live bullets flying around you. Now, what I think the Browns have done a nice job of, including with Pickett, is trying to get Gabriel, Sanders, and Pickett up to speed. Because you can't compete in the NFL at any level unless you know what you're doing, right? And it's not only knowing what your players are doing against a specific defense, but then you got to know what your plays are and the adjustments are with your players when the defense adjusts to what you're doing. So those take reps, right? Live reps, not walkthroughs, not things on the board, live reps. And that's why I think Flacco has the advantage going in, just because he's seen not only what's going to happen with the original play design, but what happens with the defensive adjustments. Pickett's a guy that, you know, it's just like with Sanders, I said it a bunch, right? These guys have gotten way too much praise and way too much criticism without any pads on. Let's see when the pads go on and they're seeing live bullets around them, what they can do. Now, Pickett fits in very well with Stefanski, right? He's good at play action. He throws the ball well from different launch points. He can throw that levels concept. He's tough. He doesn't have, you know, because like we were talking earlier, if you run the ball pretty well, they're going to crowd the line of scrimmage. It makes the, it always like my, I always felt like one of my goals as a quarterback coach was I got to try to make that picture clear for the quarterback or make the window less things in the window. So the quarterback makes it easy for him. Pickett can do those things. And for me, you know, I was listening to you guys about the, you know, and Nick yesterday about the tiers. For me, there's two tiers. There's quarterbacks you win with. And there's quarterbacks you win because of, and there's very few quarterbacks you win because of. I think Pickett's a guy that you can win with if you surround him with the right people.
Oh, I love talking about that list Nick put out yesterday. He had one in particular that kind of messed me up in the head because I try to put these quarterbacks on every other team and see what they would do. And he had Burrow in the non-elite, basically that second category, but yet he put Jalen Hurts in the elite category. And I think you got to flip those guys.
Well, I'm a big Burrow fan, right? And Burrow's a guy you can win because of. There's only four guys. It's Burrow, it's Mahomes, Jackson, and Allen. Those are guys you can win because of. And what that means is their defense isn't very strong. They don't have great receivers. The run game is not there. You're winning because of that guy. And for me, there's only four guys. Now, Jalen Hurts falls into the quarterbacks you can win with, right? And it goes all the way down to Anthony Richardson, who's last on my list. And what I mean by that is, Jalen Hurts needs a lot more support in terms of those four guys. And as you get down the list, the guys who struggle with skills or whatever it may be, they need more support, right? And obviously, if you get lower and lower, then you got to find a new quarterback. But if you don't have a quarterback, for me, there's only four quarterbacks that you win because of them, then you got to figure out, you know, the rest of your roster. And for me, everybody in the NFL besides four teams are working on how do we improve our roster to improve our quarterback, because if it's not a guy who you can just throw it 55 times a game, then what do we have to do? And I think the Browns are on the right track with that in terms of running the ball, playing really good defense, having an elite defensive line, going back to the run game, shorten the game. They won't be pretty, but wins are pretty. It doesn't matter if you win 2-0 or 50-0. It's W's and L's. And I think, you know, the quarterback position is that way. But, yeah, I'm with you. Burrow is an elite guy, but there's very few of those guys in the NFL. The rest are trying to figure out how do we make this roster fit with the guy we have.
My top five Cleveland Browns since 1999, Nick Chubb, Myles Garrett, Joe Thomas, Phil Dawson. I'm going to say Denzel Ward. Did I make a glaring omission of Josh Cribbs or Baker Mayfield?
Well, I'll tell you what. I got one guy that I think gets overlooked. I love Cribbs, obviously KSU alum. I love Cribbs. I love what he did. I love his attitude. But a guy that I really think kind of epitomizes what the Browns want to be is Jarvis Landry. Right, he's a guy that came in and he just had an attitude, and he's a guy that's not super talented but super tough and has a little bit of grit to him, and just toughness that you like to see in football guys, especially the Cleveland area. So for me, I think that's a great list. You know, Garrett, you can't go wrong with guys who are going to be Hall of Famers, Joe Thomas and Garrett, and Chubb's my all-time, you know, for me as a fan as well. Chubb is just a guy you love. And as a coach, you go down there and watch him practice. Chubb practiced like he was fighting for a spot when he was a Hall of Famer type guy. Like, you go down there and he was first in line, and he's just a guy you can't help but love if you're a football coach. So, no, I don't think you missed out on those guys. I think it's a good list. I think, you know, there's a lot of Browns since 1999. So I think, you know, if you're even 20th on the list, it's pretty good, right? So, no, I don't think you missed. Cribbs would have been in there, and maybe Jarvis Landry.
All right, I'll take that. I mean, I respect people's opinions when they say Josh Cribbs. I don't think they're crazy. Coach, we thank you very much for the time. Of course, we'll talk to you again very soon. All the best.
Absolutely, guys. Thanks for having me. We'll talk soon.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Greene from the Commercial Break Podcast. It's likely you've heard of the show if you're directly related to me or you follow our MySpace page. But I'm not here to talk to those three listeners. I'm here to appeal to people who haven't heard the show. Along with my co-host, Kristen Joy Hoadley, we're taking a deeper look at the topics that are affecting our youth today. Like, who are the people who are dating ghosts? Where did all these pickup artists come from? And why doesn't my preacher have a nicer private jet? We understand that these are the issues you really want to get to the bottom of. The Commercial Break is now available on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.
Joining us now on the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. He covers everything for the News Herald. Longtime Browns beat reporter. He's Mr. Jeff Shudell. Hello, Jeffrey.
He is a man for all seasons. Hi, guys. Hey, is it hard to do that job wearing boxing gloves for 4 hours?
The two of us?
Yeah.
As long as you have hockey boxing gloves on, you're good to
been,
go.
We've been you'll a little never, feisty today.
You'll never lose.
Been a little feisty today. Hey, I want to ask you, first of all, something that Dan brought up that we kicked around last segment. And I don't know that I agree with it, but I thought it was a really interesting point by Dan. The moves that the Browns have made this offseason, do they signify that the Browns are telling us that the entire problem was with Deshaun Watson last year and his play with what they've done on offense this year?
I think that's a big part of it. I think what they're admitting that what they did last year was a huge mistake. You think about 2023, right? They win 11 games with four quarterbacks, yet they fire their offensive coordinator and change the entire scheme to suit Deshaun Watson. Then it doesn't work, and now they go back to what worked before. So I think it is an admission that the whole let's cater to Deshaun Watson, they're admitting that was a mistake.
Does that, you know, you say that, it makes me think Joe Flacco starts. I'm just saying. I don't know why, but listening to you say that makes me think that Flacco would have the edge on having success. That's the last quarterback, you know, they really had success with. So, I don't know, as we get ready for camp to start here in what, 2 weeks from tomorrow? Or no, it's even earlier than that. Give me your race. Give me the depth chart at quarterback. The Jeff Shedell depth chart.
You know, I would have to say it's Flacco, then Kenny Pickett. And then the two rookies are tied for third. And I read all these stories about Deshaun Watson, about Shador Sanders, how he looked great in these mini camps and the OTAs and everything. Well, I was there for every one of those, and I did not see that. I'm not saying he was bad or anything, but he certainly wasn't head and shoulders above everybody else, as all these stories written by people who were not there try to say.
Interesting.
I trust your eyes, Jeff.
That's right.
You've watched a lot of football.
Shedell, we trust. That's what we say around here all the time. I walk around the hall. Jeff says, I'm like, who do you trust? And he goes, Shedell.
Do one of these four guys intrigue you more than any of the others, Jeff, of the four quarterbacks?
Well, I mean, if Flacco, of course, because he's so experienced. I mean, he gets out there and he makes it look so easy the way he throws the football. But let's also remember they were in shorts. This is just 7-on-7 or 11-on-11 with no pass rush. If you don't look good as a quarterback with nobody rushing you, then you have a real problem.
With that in mind, could Joe Flacco have more than a year, more than 2 years? I mean, is there any chance that he becomes Tom Brady and plays another 3 or 4 years and he could actually be the quarterback here for a while? I don't think we've really thought about that possibility because of the draft picks next year and drafting two young guys this year, but maybe on that? What do you think?
Oh, there may be. I mean, now we have to remember that, you know, that he did not look great with the Colts last year, but I think that was a different situation. He went in there expecting to not be the starter, expecting Richardson to start, and then he did not play great when he was in there. But we know that he's comfortable in the offense that the Browns use. And we'll just have to see how this plays out. I really don't see him being the starter for 2 or 3 more years after this. But you never know, right? I mean, maybe he could be the next Tom Brady. He's not going to run a lot. And if the offensive line, I heard you guys talking about the offensive line having a down year last year. And I think that was a lot of it was because they did change the whole blocking scheme. I don't think they had a lot of respect for Andy Dickerson, their coach. They love Blomgren, the new guy. And I think the offensive line is going to play better, protect whoever the starter is, we'll say Flacco, and maybe that could extend his career for another year.
Hmm. Of the running backs, I'm not asking you to tell me, I thought you made a great point about it's 7-on-7. It's shorts. It's not, no one's got pads on. But I just give me your theory on the running backs this year and how this thing could shake out, should shake out, and can it be successful, especially with two young guys.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to Quinshon Judkins. I think he's going to be a good player. He won't make people forget Nick Chubb, but I think he's going to play well behind this line with the blocking, wide zone blocking scheme that they're using. And on Nick Chubb, everybody wishes him well in Houston. And it is sad that you have to move on from a player like him. But the fact is, sometimes you do just have to move on. And I think that's where the Browns are. I think someday he'll be in the Ring of Honor. I hope he is. The thing, it was a good relationship, obviously, and he liked it here, but they did have to move on from him.
Jeff Shadell joining us from the News Herald. Let me hit you up with some Guardians thoughts. Three straight wins over the Astros, great. After a 10-game losing streak, does it change your thought process at all, Jeff? Did the losing streak change your thought process about where this team is and what it should be doing with the trade deadline coming up, or what it should be doing with maybe anybody in the minor leagues you should bring up or guys in the major leagues that you should send down?
I heard you guys talking about this before, and I come up with some numbers. The Guardians are 20, even with that sweep of the Astros, they're 21-37 against teams with winning records. I think that's a pretty sobering number when you think about, hey, maybe they can do something if they catch on as a wild card team. On the other hand, when you look at the series coming up, when you take the Kansas City series out of it, the teams that are playing are 130-240. I mean, that's the White Sox, the Orioles, Athletics, and the Rockies. So if they should make hay after, through that, if they should be at least 500, probably above, after they're done with that Colorado series. But as far as the trades go, I would not trade Class A. If you think maybe that this was a down year and then they could bounce back next year, when you think about his contract, he could be under club control through 2028, and he'll be making $10 million in 2027 and 28. So that for the Guardians, that should be a bargain. But if you do trade him, or you trade Santana, you have to get players who are major league ready or almost major league ready, like Kyle Manzardo. So I don't want them to go get some guys who are really looking good in Double A. They have to get somebody who's ready to help now or next year.
Just going back to the overall picture, you know, to get back in that wild card race, two of the teams they've got to jump are two teams that are right ahead of them, Kansas City and Minnesota. They have seven games against them. I think that's one of the reasons why I might have a little bit of optimism to be able to jump up. You're not going to get that third wild card spot if you're not in second place in the at least is what I think. You've got to at least be in second place in the Central, because otherwise I don't see three teams from the Central making the playoffs. But
A good point.
And so is that a reason for optimism, knowing that there's 14 games still against those two teams? And, you know, you're making a full game's hay against them when you can do that. And, you know, I want to be optimistic, Jeff. I think that's what the whole thing is. And I can see pathways to do that. And then you just crushed all my dreams by talking about how bad they are against good teams. Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate you.
But you're right. And now really the Central Division is back to being the Central Division that it was prior to last year. The Tigers are the only team over 500 in the division. But, you know, they would certainly have to pass the Twins and the Royals. There are a lot of teams in there that they would have to jump. It's not so much, I mean, that they're 4.5 out now, but it's all the teams that they have to jump. But still, when they were 7.5 out of the wild card before playing the Astros. So they didn't gain three games in 3 nights. But they, you know, they have to jump the Red Sox and a few other teams, the Yankees, right? So I think it's going to be difficult to make the playoffs, to be honest. But still, like I said, if they trade one of those guys, they have to get someone who could help now. Because the guy, you know, I heard you guys talking about the Lauder.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know what to do with him. I mean, I don't think the Guardians do. And Jonathan Rodriguez, you have a lot more faith in him than I do, Jeff.
I want to see if he can do it, Jeff. You know, there comes a time when a guy who dominates at one level has to perform at the next, or it's time to move on. You know, he's on his way to a fine career in Japan. And I want to see somebody out there. And I was just going to ask you about the whole platooning thing. I want to see Rodriguez. I want to see Noel. I want to see Nolan Jones get enough at bats where they can make a real decision on them. And I don't think that's happening right now. What do you think of the platooning they're doing in the, you know, when you don't commit to somebody, it's either because you've got a plan that may or may not work, or you just don't believe in these guys. What do you think it is?
Yeah, I think the platooning sometimes gets overboard. But and like Andy was saying, when you have five guys hitting under 180, you're not going to win too many games 8-6, you're not going to score 10 runs like they did a couple of nights ago when Martinez had that grand slam. You're not going to do that with guys that are hitting 180. And maybe I don't understand really why batting average isn't important anymore like it used to be. I mean, if you can't get on base, you're probably not going to win many games.
True.
I would agree with you on that. The fact that there are so many teams to jump makes it challenging. I understand that. I just think it's decision time on so many of these guys. And, you know, they've been shuffling guys at second base. Brito's been hurt. That's part of it. They're waiting for Bizana. You're shuffling guys at shortstop because Rocchio didn't do the job early on. Now he's back. Maybe he gets it. Center field, right field as well. When you have so many positions that are up for grabs and the guys who are there aren't producing, Jeff, I just think it's going to make what we all want, contention for a wild card spot, just a major challenge that I don't know if it's achievable.
Right. And you're right. You don't see that. I don't see these players who are here now, up here now, getting better. I mean, you're this far into the season. If you're a 200 hitter, you're not going to get better than that. And you know, the catching, we haven't mentioned the catching situation. I mean, you got Austin Hedges and Bo Naylor. I think their combined batting average,
Jeff,
when you add them together,
161.
Yeah.
That's what Guardians catchers are hitting this year, 161.
Yeah, right. And, I mean, you cannot win with that consistently. And Austin Hedges is a great, great defensive catcher. Would he have blocked that pitch that the other night that was ruled a wild pitch, but probably should have been blocked that led the, you know, one strike away from winning the game, right? But Bo Naylor didn't make that, you know, didn't block that pitch, and then everything fell apart after that. I would like them to somehow find a catcher who could at least hit, you know, 230. But I don't know where those guys come from either.
Jeff, thank you for your time, sir. We always appreciate your perspective.
Thanks, guys, for having me.
Thanks, Jeff.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Green from the Commercial Break Podcast. It's likely you've heard of the show if you're directly related to me or you follow our MySpace page. But I'm not here to talk to those three listeners. I'm here to appeal to people who haven't heard the show. Along with my co-host, Kristen Joy Hoadley, we're taking a deeper look at the topics that are affecting our youth today. Like, who are the people who are dating ghosts? Where did all these pickup artists come from? And why doesn't my preacher have a nicer private jet? We understand that these are the issues you really want to get to the bottom of. The Commercial Break is now available on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.
Our next guest is going to be able to give us the spotlight on both those things. ESPN LA, ESPN NBA, the man, the myth, the legend, the guy that I will absolutely text if I need tequila recommendations because he's never steered me wrong once. George Sedano appears now on the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. George, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. I will say, we like the La Drama. Does LA, does the city of Los Angeles like the La Drama right now?
No, I think they're kind of over it, especially knowing that we're kind of closer to the end here, regardless of what transpires this season, whether it's one more beyond this or whatnot. But yeah, I think LeBron is very much a lightning rod here. I don't think he's ever truly been beloved here. I think that the smart fans, and there's plenty of them, particularly the ones that go to the games, they appreciate what he's done. But, you know, social media is a weird place, right? And fans, I think there's a sect of the fans, right? Like a section of the fans that have been like Kobe fans that have always just kind of looked at him as an outsider, as a rival or whatnot. And they'll just never accept him. It's funny because everything he said, or Rich Paul said in this statement, is what every Laker fan kind of thinks already. Like, he's basically implying the team is not championship good when you look at this roster. And it's hard to argue that they are, at least in my opinion. Like, I think he's right. So, like, I said this on my radio show yesterday. I'm like, what is LeBron saying that Laker fans don't agree with? They just don't agree with the messenger. But they absolutely don't think this roster, at least for the most part, most people don't think this roster is championship good, especially in the Western Conference.
I mean, so if that's true, then the door should be open for LeBron to leave, right?
I guess Brian Windhorst said it best, right? Where he said, like, I unlocked the door. The door's not open. But I would feel a similar sentiment. Like, I don't think it's, a 0% chance that he leaves, right? I think that it's more than that, perhaps. Now, how much more? I mean, that's all subjective, right? But I do think that he wants to see what the team looks like, and I don't blame him. Like, you know, it feels like this team, at least based on reporting, is looking, quote unquote, towards the future, like Rich said, and this plan of like preserving cap space for the next couple of years. And I know it's not like traditional free agency where guys just sign into your cap space, but having cap space will allow you to absorb perhaps players that, or a player that you're interested in regarding roster construction, and that makes it easier. It certainly facilitates things, and that means you have to give up less player assets as opposed to draft capital and things of that nature. And I know that's a little bit in the weeds, but anyway, they've kind of prioritized having flexibility in regards to their finances, and I'm guessing he's like, hey man, I just want to win. Like, this is the end, or at least close to it. Like, I want to try to win, and why wouldn't you try to win when you have LeBron and Luka on your team?
Is there a drop-dead date for this passive-aggressive civil war between the Lakers and LeBron where there's not just going to go on infinitum?
No. I mean, listen, now he's done things like this during the season. Like, you know, I mean, listen, I have said to Laker fans, though, and I've said it to the Lakers if they're actually listening to me, they've lived a very charmed life regarding LeBron. Like, the passive-aggressiveness, okay, whatever, it is what it is. It's kind of always what he's done. But, like, in Cleveland, particularly that second time around, it was, like, aggressive. I mean, I'm sure David Griffin could tell plenty of tales, you know, sitting having some beers or tequila, as you mentioned earlier, and tell you about the challenges. While it was certainly, you know, he certainly provides the opportunity to win championships, and certainly at that time he did. You know, there is a level of stress that comes with having to deal with LeBron's demands on a very regular basis. Like, you remember his time there. I'm sure as well as anyone, right? Like, you guys lived it where it wasn't just the off season. It was the trade deadline, and there was always pressure to add more and more and more. And the Lakers haven't had that pressure from LeBron in the way that the Cavs had to deal with it.
What do you think Luka's rooting for?
I don't know. I mean, LeBron's like his guy. Like, he grew up loving the guy, you know? So I think Luka's kind of like in this weird spot where, let's just say, like, you've got, like, a friend group, right? and you've had this friend group, right? Like you're all of a sudden you're all good, right? And then two of the three are not, right? And you're just kind of there trying to be like cool. And that's kind of Luka right now. Like he's kind of this third wheel that's like, hey, LeBron and I are cool. Like the Lakers and I want to be cool. Like it seems like we're cool. They're cluing me in on stuff. But I kind of feel weird because I really like LeBron. So it's just a weird spot they've put him in too.
George, outside of the decision 15 years ago, pretty much every move LeBron has made career-wise, every time he's left a team, it's helped build a narrative that fulfills his legacy as, you know, potentially the GOAT or the heir apparent to Jordan. So if we say in a year, LeBron is still capable of being the guy that brings a championship to a town, where would winning his final championship and maybe his final season help LeBron's legacy the most?
Well, I think going back to Cleveland makes all the sense in the world. I've never felt LeBron should go to a fourth team. So I've always said if he's going to leave the Lakers, it should be Miami or Cleveland, and Cleveland making the most sense by a large margin. So, and the Cavs are ready-made. You know, I don't know what those machinations would look like, and obviously it's way more difficult with Cleveland because they're dealing with the second apron stuff. So, you know, making a deal is tough because you can't aggregate salaries, and it makes things way more complicated. You need to involve more teams, which certainly complicates things if you wanted to do something. But I think the problem was everybody in the league, for the most part, was caught off guard by that statement that Rich Paul made. Now, the Lakers were clued in that there was a statement coming, and so was Luka. I don't know if they knew the exact wording that would be in that statement, but yeah, like I just think everybody was caught off guard, and perhaps there would be some inquiries or more inquiries, because my colleague Dave McMiniman has reported that there have been some inquiries, and I think it could have been even more than that, more than what we've already seen, if people kind of had an idea of what it is he wanted to do, or if this statement was even coming prior to it being released, whatever it was now, a week or so ago.
Well, let's pretend it was Garland and Allen in the mix and some other, maybe Max Strus or something like that. But the main core is LeBron, it's Donovan, and it's Evan Mobley. Is that a title contender or even title winner?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the Cavs are the current odds favorite to win the East at the moment, if I recall correctly. I think they're at about a 55.5 win pace,
yeah,
according to ESPN Bet. And you give them LeBron, Donovan, and Mobley, and I think they're the best team in the Eastern Conference. I don't see a team that's better than that. And, you know, maybe the Knicks, I guess, sort of could compete with that. But I'm not a big believer in the Knicks as a championship team. I think the Knicks have been pretty lucky now that Indiana is in the state that they're in, and the Cavs are really the only team currently constituted and built in a way that they could get in the Knicks' way. And I actually think the Cavs are better on paper. So you add LeBron to that mix, you take out Garland. I guess you'd have to figure out how to replace the two guards specifically, and you know, you'd have to get another center, right? Like, and there's ways that Mobley could play center, I guess, if you really needed to. But yeah, I mean, look, I think if you had those three pieces, just to answer your question, yes, I think they'd be the favorite to win the East, and I think that they would be near the top of teams that can win the title. I think they wouldn't be where OKC is, maybe not even where Houston is, but they'd be kind of in that next group of teams.
George, LeBron has made no secret he wants to be an NBA owner after his playing days are over. There was a recent Forbes report saying the buzz towards an NBA expansion franchise in Las Vegas is grown, and that LeBron is quietly putting together a group of investors to try and, you know, make a bid on that. Does the NBA owe LeBron James a franchise after his playing days are over?
I don't think they owe him anything. I think that, you know, if he wants to put in a bid, then I think he'll if it's the best bid, he'll win. But I don't think anybody owes anybody anything. I think LeBron has certainly done a lot for the league, and I think that, you know, that stands on its own. I don't think you need to conflate the two things.
Has the market for Darius Garland, is it dried up at all?
I don't know. I mean, I think he's a very useful player. Like, he's a really good player. I mean, he has some drawbacks, right? Like, he is not a good defensive player. But you know, if you put him on the right team that has a bunch of wings that can defend and bigs that can defend, like, you're good. Like, the problem with the Cavs is that in the playoffs, you're only as good as your weakest link defensively. So you have to make sure everybody out there can guard their position to as best they can, right? Or at least not be someone that's a liability. And I think that, at the very least, in regards to the way I look at them, even if they were healthy, and they weren't, so I don't think it was a fair assessment what we saw at the end of last season, I think that it's incumbent upon him to find ways to be able to at least be a good help defender, a good team defender, and not be a guy who's a target out there.
George, I can be honest with you, man. I love what they've done in the regular season, but I 3 years into Donovan, and I wonder if Donovan feels the same way, it just hasn't gone quite where we hoped it would yet. And the Cavs, for their point, have said, specifically like Darius, you have to blow us away to get this guy. So it's not even 100 cents on the dollar value. It's maybe 110% value on the dollar. Is that the right tack? Are the Cavs in the right if that's their mentality here?
Listen, I'm not going to question Colby Altman. Like, he's done a fantastic job. So I think beauty's in the eye of the beholder, right? And I think that, you know, prices change depending on circumstances. So I think that we'll just kind of have to wait and see how that plays out. I think, to me, and I've told you this before, is for the Cavs to be a championship team, Mobley has to be their best player. Now, he's certainly their best player defensively, and he's come a long way offensively over the last couple of years, but he has to be someone that is a go-to guy offensively. I'm not saying that Donovan didn't do a great job of empowering him and his teammates. I think, if anything, and I voted Donovan first team All-NBA this year, I think Donovan really let his guys feel empowered in a lot of ways. His minutes were down, his shots were down. Like, he was really good about being the best teammate possible. And I know, look, I've had those conversations with Kenny about Donovan and what he wanted to do coming into the season. And those were conversations he and Kenny had about making sure those guys felt like they could carry their weight. And they did during the regular season. I think, unfortunately, you know, sometimes this is a battle of attrition and the injuries really caught up with them at the wrong time.
Something that came out in the past hour or so, Suns assistant coach DeMar Carroll, he was with the Cavs, obviously, and the Suns head coach Jordan Ott was there as well. And he said that, Carroll said today that he thought Jordan Ott was the mastermind and said that, last year in Cleveland, he ran through that whole offense for us. Do you have any inside track on anything like that? Like, do you feel like people around the league think that was more Jordan Ott's offense than it was Atkinson's offense, or is that just assistant speaking up for a head coach in a new situation?
You know, I have not heard that, but I know that Jordan was certainly a guy that was earmarked as a head coach prospect for a number of years, including when he was here in L.A. Under Darvin Ham. So it wouldn't surprise me if he had a huge amount of influence on the offense. But Kenny has also proven that he's been pretty darn good wherever he's been. Like, he got a raw deal in Brooklyn. Like, that team was not a good team, and he made them very competitive in a circumstance where they shouldn't have been competitive, and then got the boot because the stars that were there didn't want him basically at that particular time. So, I think two things can be true. I think that Ott could be a fantastic offensive coach, and I think that Kenny has certainly proven that he is a hell of a head coach.
George, you're a hell of an interview. We always appreciate you, buddy. Thank you so much. And again, just great stuff, bud.
You got it, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. George Sedano there. Sedano and Cap on ESPN LA, ESPN NBA coverage on the North Homestead Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. We will react to everything he had to say about LeBron, the Cavaliers, and Donovan Mitchell borrowed time. That's in 5 minutes on 92.3 The Fan.
Terry is on the line right now. Terry, how are you?
I'm well.
Hello, Mr. Pluto.
Hello there, Jeff.
Can we talk about vacations with you two? Let's just go right to it.
No.
We don't want to do that. All right, then let's go to the Guardians. Terry, your thoughts on where they are right now. That's a horrific losing streak they're coming off of last night. And just, how does this thing get better, or does this thing become a fire sale quicker than we ever thought it would this year?
Well, when people keep saying stuff like that, fire sale as in who?
Anybody who's got a contract that's up within the next, I don't know, year, or would you give up somebody like Kwan?
Names, please. I don't mean to be a jerk, but
no, that's okay.
But, make a point. Names, please.
Wait, say that again.
Names.
I know where you're going, Terry, and I've thought the same thing.
About
the only thing I think is this: if some team thinks Bieber could be healthy and help them this year and next, if he's not going to pick up his option here. And maybe if a team needs Carlos Santana, if they need a first baseman. Other than that, I don't think they have a lot of trade of value to trade.
Well, then here's the other one I was going to go was, like, this bothers me over the last 2 days. Like, you start hearing Kwan's name because he's got arbitration coming, and then you're like, well, you know what? We're like Pavlov's dogs, and we're already trained to let these guys go if they're a good player or not. And we're just used to it by now, so let's see what they can get for him. I guess that's where I'm saying fire sale. Look down the road.
I mean, to Jeff's point, you don't have much to fire sale. This is not like even when they had Mike Clevenger to get rid of, or who had turned down a lot of different extensions, or when they had, Lindor. Really, if you look at it, they don't always just trade everybody. I mean, heck, Bieber just signed an extension, you know, all those kind of things. Bieber did too, but I was thinking of Bibby. The point that I'm saying is they don't have that much to sell because most of the guys that they have are younger and there wouldn't be that appealing. You know, Class A would be very appealing to both, should be both to Cleveland and also to other teams. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now, Paul Sewald is making more money than Class A.
Wow.
That's interesting. What's Class A worth if you're trying to rebuild things and you're tired of watching guys
well,
that are written
here's what
less
he's
than 240?
He's 27. Huh? He's under contract for 4.6 this year and I think 5 next year. And I forgot whether it's 2 or 3 team options following that for $10 million a year.
Yeah, I think it's 2, Terry.
2, sorry, 4 years. 3 and a half left. I mean, as I said, Paul Sewald's making more money than he is. Barlow last year made more money. Because they signed him, and he—you got to understand what cost they did that. He's got a lot of family responsibilities back in the Dominican, and he was able to sign that long-term contract, get a bunch of money pushed up front, and take care of his family. So it's not like anybody did a stupid deal or whatever. People are in different spots in their life, and frankly, most of the time when you're a pitcher and you're young, and they throw an extension at you, take it.
Because you never
know when Tommy John comes knocking on that door.
Yeah, like Bibby did.
But nonetheless, it hasn't on Class A, so therefore, it's a really interesting question there. I mean, he's the one guy that might bring back a lot of assets, but the rest of these guys, I mean, okay, so you move Carlos for whatever, and you could play Manzardo at first and bring up Kafis, and you could bring him to Lauder, but that it's not like they have these bigger name guys to trade like in the past, Cliff Lee for a bunch of people or Sabathia, and now that's going way back since they're both retired. It's interesting to me too, how sometimes we get frozen on things that as we get a little older, we don't realize how far back they are in the rearview mirror.
True.
Terry, would you think about Class A? I mean, a closer is a huge part of a good team, a team that's struggling might not need a closer as badly as a team that's knocking on the door, yet the Guardians have tons of bullpen guys who you think could be closers.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a possibility. Of course, as I mentioned before, because he has such great team control, it isn't about this year for him at all. It's just about how big of an asset do you think he is and that kind of stuff. I mean, if you look at his stats like over the last 15 games or something, I was looking at the other day, his ERA is like 1.4. I keep getting emails that he's melted down or whatever because the game the other day where Naylor couldn't block a ball through his legs. I mean, it's like, oh, please, stuff like that. But I guess the problem, as I said, the problem is there just isn't that much that you're going to trade away that's going to bring you that much in return. Unless, like Andy said, Kwan, and I would be kind of shocked if they did that. I would love to know. I'm sure they've offered him extension. I'm not sure exactly where that's at. Obviously, he didn't sign.
Is this season fixable at this point, too? And I guess it's because you have 3 wild card teams, although you have 6 teams to jump over. Like, I want to still believe that they have a chance and that it was a 10-game losing streak. And the, 1930, they were still over 500 in a very tough league when they had that 12-game losing streak. But my point is, is it salvageable? Is there something we can hang on to? Or do we need to start saying, okay, we have got to think about next year? And can five guys all be hitting under 200 in the lineup? Can it stay that way? Or is this kind of fluky? I hope it's fluky, but it's not. I don't believe that it is.
Well, the interesting thing there is because it isn't like, all right, so you trade Santana, and then you just drop in Manzardo to play some first, Cases play some first, you're opening up DH, you got David Fry, who finally hit a home run yesterday. Maybe his arm's starting to feel better or whatever, but you open that spot up, and basically the only thing you can do is bring up younger guys. You know, Lane Thomas, he's on the disabled list again with another bottle of plantar fascia. But by the way, I had that a long time ago. If you don't treat that thing right, you come back too soon, as he found out. It's not career threatening or whatever, but it is annoying. It takes a while to go away. And so I don't think they're going to line up for him. I don't know. That's, if you make a trade for Class A, you're probably making it more towards getting, it's not going to, you're going to get some guy that's going to hit 25 home runs right away. I mean, that's, they're in a spot where they've had the youngest roster in the league for the last few years, and that's what you got. You got the youngest roster.
Terry Pluto joining us from the PlainDealerCleveland.com. Everybody is clamoring for Chase DeLauder. I'd love to see him. Terry, if he's down there and hitting okay and he's been getting on base, 30 straight games, something like that, and they're not bringing him up, even if you have to put Kyle Manzardo on the family leave list and you bring up Noel, there must be some reason. They either think he's not ready or he's not healthy or something. What do you think?
Well, first of all, he'd never played more than 55 games in a pro season until this year. Think about that for a minute.
Yeah.
And then also the sports hernia thing was a fairly serious surgery. Not career threatening, but whatever. So they're trying to build him back up. And I guess when they bring him up, they want him to be able to play quite a bit. I went and I wrote a long thing on him in 2023. I watched him in a doubleheader in Lake County. I fell in baseball love with him. I mean, he's 6'2", like 220, moves well, very athletic. When he was at James Madison, by the way, his only Division I grant was from James Madison. That's an interesting story, too. Even though he was the West Virginia High School Player of the Year, I don't know what people were looking at back then. I really don't, but he was a closer for their college team. He throws 91, 92 miles an hour. So he's pretty fast. He's very athletic, and he's got a good arm, and he can hit. Other than that, he didn't have much going for him. And, of course, the negative is the health. But baseball-wise, he would have went in the top 10 or higher, but he already had the foot problem before that draft, which is why I think they got him at 18 or 19, something like that, in that draft. I want to see him.
Me too.
All right, Terry Pluto joining us, Cleveland.com. Of course, he's on the North Homestead Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram hotline. Are the Cavaliers a better team today than they were when the season ended by adding Lonzo Ball, Larry Nance Jr., Tyrese Proctor, and then re-signing Sam Merrill? What do you think of the team right now?
Okay, are they and better? The only guys, who do they subtract?
Okoro.
And Ty Jerome.
Ty Jerome, yeah.
So basically, I always kind of try to make like two lists, you know, who came, who left.
Mm-hmm.
I'll throw it to Jeff. Jeff loves basketball. What do you think?
I think they're a little better now. I like the addition of Larry Nance. And I, for some reason, the loss of Ty Jerome doesn't irk me a ton. If Lonzo Ball's, if Lonzo can play 50 games this year, I think you'll be okay.
Yeah, they got two ifs because Larry, I think, only played like 25 games last year.
Yeah, he was dinged up too.
Nance Jr. too. Because they're both what you want your teams to be about. They're unselfish in that. I mean, isn't it amazing? You know, I'm actually working on a column on Ball for tomorrow, and I forgot all the hype about him. I mean, I knew there was hype, but it was incredible, the hype about him. How about when he had his press conference where he's introduced? Magic Johnson was running the team then. He takes him over. This is in front of the media. He points to the wall where all the Lakers jerseys for retired jerseys are. He goes, and I expect to see Ball's number up there too.
Wow.
No pressure. That's easy.
No pressure. 19 years old, you know. And I think the fact that he's come through all that, and, you know, he's never had any big off-the-court problems or whatever. It's always just been the knee stuff and that. It says something. He must be a pretty strong individual. That's what I was thinking. And I'm really hoping for him. I love his game. I mean, just it's a purist game, 6'6". And even in his interview, the first thing he says, well, I defend, I push the ball up the floor, and I take some shots when they're there. I mean, that's your essence of a team-first point guard.
His game is terrific. It's I wonder, you know, where did he find the ligaments to put in the knee? Congratulations to that. But 35 games.
Yeah, he found it from a cadaver, by the way.
I know. That's
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
You know, and that, we got to make sure they hold, but it was almost like considered like a quote-unquote Hail Mary surgery when he had it. Well, I mean, it was a big deal. So I'm pulling
same
really
thing for
hard
Tommy for John back in the day, right? That's worked.
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually, because they had to do Carlo, it was even more – it's just more complicated than everything. It really is. So I'm pulling for him. I thought his press conference, he handled it very well. You know, Okoro became unplayable in the playoffs, so it's not a big loss there. And, you know, Ty Jerome, until this year, I think had never played more than 50-some games. He had an injury history, too. Probably these are kind of moves around the edges, if you really look at it. You know, bringing Proctor, maybe he helps, maybe he doesn't this year. I'm a little more hopeful on Tyson. I kind of like Tyson's game. And I think Porter, too. I just think they underused him.
Hopefully. I think the opportunities are. I know Jeff and I have talked about that, too, to see if they start using him more. Do you think is the best path to maybe changing things up a little bit more by trading Garland and understanding what the second apron is here, which is extremely confusing and feels like handcuffs on the franchise trying to make moves? But is Garland the key to making another move if they need to? Are you in? We hear a lot about it, you know?
Well, you have to pretend you're another team. So I'm trading for a guy who just had toe surgery. They haven't said publicly what kind, but they said he's out 4 to 6 months. Just let that hang there for a minute.
Yeah.
And then there's I think it's 124 million over the next, was it 4 years or something like that. And it's a lot of money. And how deep do you want to go there? And they're in the second apron. It's very complicated, but basically they would have to almost get the exact contract in return. You can't put two together. Am I correct on that, Jeff?
Yeah, I think that's right on the money. Yeah.
Yeah. So in other words, you got to find a guy making $36 million.
It makes it all very, very interesting. Terry, thank you. We appreciate you joining us. We're up against the top of the hour. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. We hope to talk to you soon here.
Thanks, Terry.
Okay. Bye-bye.
How do they get back on track? What is their actual plan here? Because a lot of people are upset with the Guardians not cashing in on the ALCS and not making themselves a better organization. Well, Tim Kirkjian's as plugged in as anybody has ever been in the history of baseball. And he joins us right now on the North Homestead Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline, courtesy ESPN. And Is This a Great Game or What podcast with his son, Jeff Kirkjian. Tim Kirkjian joins us right now on the show. Tim, thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure, fellas. How are you?
We're doing wonderful. So a lot of people here in Cleveland are very upset with the Cleveland Guardians. What is their plan to bounce back from this season that looks like it's starting to tailspin and get back to within contention in the American League?
Yeah, well, they have to add some offense at some point because, you know, they are 27th in the major leagues in runs scored. They're hitting 227 as a team. And I know it's the hardest hitting environment that we've ever seen in the history of baseball. I don't know how anyone gets a hit anymore with the pitching that we see, but you got to find more offense than what the Guardians have right now. And it's a challenge to find good hitters because the good hitters are staying with their current teams because teams need hitters so badly. So, I mean, the Guardians scored 7 runs in a game last night, and they had scored 7 runs in their previous 5 games combined. So this is what has to be done. They're going to have to go find some hitters somewhere. And like I said, that's easier said than done.
Yeah, Tim, obviously this has been a really rough stretch for Guardians fans. I've made the point that fans that have been annoyed with ownership over the last decade have had to be quiet many of the years because they've won as many games as they have. In fact, fourth most over the last decade If you do the math, the three teams ahead of them, all of the biggest spenders in baseball. And yet there's been an outpouring of negativity over the last 48 hours in this town, not only for ownership, but for management. You're somebody who's not rooted in Cleveland, but you certainly follow what goes on. What would you say to that criticism?
Well, it's easy to say we need to spend a lot more money in order to improve the team, but the Guardians don't have a lot of money. The reason they've been so good over the years is they've drafted and developed players pretty darn well, and Chris Antonetti and his group deserve a lot of credit for the job that they have done with the Guardians. Now, ownership is going to have to get more involved here and try whatever it takes to improve this team, but you're right, they've been pretty darn good, and I'm just not sure that it's really fair to blast ownership and blast the front office for not improving this team when they've done an awful lot of good things the last few years.
Well, then, Tim, I guess I'd have to ask, because, I mean, it's been a long time and championships don't fall off of trees. What would you say to the fans that then say, well, if he's that hard up for money, maybe Paul Dolan should just sell the team officially to David Blitzer, who seems to be the owner in waiting?
Yeah, well, again, that's easy to say when it's, you know, it's not your team and it's not your money. But look, it's okay for Guardians fans to be frustrated. I totally understand that. I would be frustrated also, but it just doesn't work that easily. We, you know, when you have teams with payrolls like we have in the big leagues and others with payrolls that are $250 million less, it's really hard to work that way. But this is where we are right now. And you lose 10 games in a row a year after making the playoffs, and you're 15 and a half games out before the All-Star break. That's a tough pill to swallow. I totally understand that, but it's just not that easy in baseball to put things together year after year after year without significant resources to deal with.
Tim Kirkshin joining us right now on the hotline. So I love getting your perspective because we're in it every day. And, you know, baseball, we tend to follow our own teams more than we watch, you know, the rest of the teams the way we do in the other sports. With that said, I mean, this team made an ALCS run a year ago. Then they get rid of Naylor, and we know the tightening of the money. They lost the $40 to $50 million in local cable TV revenue. So they have that much less to spend. They already weren't spending that much. Fans are really irritated that you could be an ALCS team one year and then slash payroll the next. Do you think that's a Guardians problem or a baseball problem?
Well, it's a baseball problem. I mean, just look at the Atlanta Braves, what's happened to them this year. Look at the Baltimore Orioles, what's happened to them this year. This is one of the ultimate beauties of baseball to me. This isn't going to do any good for Guardians fans, but teams get really good and really bad one season to the next, way more in this sport than any other sport. And that's what separates baseball. That's what makes it so interesting. How can the Guardians be struggling like this a year after going to the ALCS? Same thing's being asked in Baltimore, same in Atlanta, and every year there are teams that really disappoint you. I mean, I just saw the Texas Rangers. They, for three games in San Diego, I mean, they won the World Series 2 years ago, and now they're one of the worst hitting teams in the major leagues. It doesn't make any sense. Baseball doesn't make any sense, which is one of its greatest attributes, is you can't figure it out from year to year. And the Guardians are a team you can't figure out from year to year, other than their bullpen, which is still great, isn't as great as it was last year. And their offense just hasn't been enough to get them anywhere close to the Tigers in the Central.
Tim Kirkjian joining us here on the show. So we've done a lot of wondering about people's futures on this in this organization. Jose Ramirez is unthinkable. I know he has no trade clause and everything like that. So I'm not going to insult your intelligence or time with that. Stephen Kwan, I mean, he's got two more years of player control within this organization. I don't think they would move on from him until possibly next July. What do you think is more possible, though? Do you think it's more possible that they extend Stephen Kwan, give him money, or that they actually were to trade him at some point here over the next couple of years?
Well, I would hope for Guardians fans and for the Guardians, they would extend him rather than trade him. Stephen Kwan is a really good player, as everybody knows, and just as important the way he presents himself on a daily basis, the way he plays the game with intelligence and with, you know, with grit every single day. That's the kind of guy you need to build around. Plus, in this era where everybody strikes out because the pitching is so amazing, this is a guy who plays the game a little differently. He puts the ball in play. So I would, without a doubt, again, not my money, but I would extend Stephen Kwan before I would deal him.
You know, Kenny mentioned just now, Tim, Jose Ramirez. And when you look over the span of, you know, the last decade, six top six MVPs in the American League, three top threes. He's having another sensational year at the age of 32. Do you think he gets the respect nationally that you think he probably should?
Not really. I think everyone in the game recognizes what a great player he is and what a great player he's been. He has four top five finishes in the MVP race and has yet never won one. And the only two active players who have the same four top five finishes are Manny Machado and Nolan Arenado, and they haven't won an MVP either. So it's very interesting to me that there are three third basemen out there with the same MVP caliber voting, four top five finishes, and no MVPs to their name. But Ramirez is one of them. And people in the game recognize exactly who he is and what he's done. Maybe the average fan doesn't appreciate it, but dopes like me understand that that guy is on his way to the Hall of Fame at a very, very fast rate, given what he's done by age 32.
Tim, I think it's always fun to discuss, especially in baseball, guys that play today historically with guys that played way back when. It has that type of rich history intertwined with Americana, so we know the names. But how do you go about comparing Shohei Ohtani to the greats that have ever played when he's doing something that you have to go back so far in time to find guys that actually both pitched and hit?
Yeah, he's different. He's like nobody who's ever played the game. Now, I am slightly different on this, that I think in 1920, if there had been a designated hitter in the American League, Babe Ruth would have hit 50 homers and won 20 games. I really believe that. And I still believe that Babe Ruth is the greatest player of all time, just because he did it much longer than Ohtani has. And he was a great pitcher for a long time. He still has as many career shutouts as Pedro Martinez. Think about that for a second. However, Ohtani is the most remarkable player that's ever played the game. I don't think there can even be an argument about that, because as much as I love Babe Ruth, he wasn't hitting balls at 100 miles an hour as consistently as Ohtani does. He wasn't hitting pitches at 100 miles an hour as often as Ohtani does, and he didn't throw 100 miles an hour like Ohtani does. So he's a different guy. There's never been anybody like him. We need to recognize that we've never seen this player before, and I don't think I will ever see, I'm 68, I don't think I will ever see another player quite like Shohei Ohtani. That's who he is, and that's who he's going to continue to be.
Tim Kirkchian joining us on the show. He's the host of Is This a Great Game or What podcast with his son, Jeff Kirkchian, also of ESPN. He's an author. You know him very, very well. One of the best brains about baseball. Are we headed towards a work stoppage here soon?
Boy, I sure hope not. This is not a good time to shut down baseball, but the people I've talked to are not encouraged about the 2027 season, what's going to happen. But if they are really diligent, they have to get back to work, and I mean right now, in order to make sure that there is no strike or no work stoppage of any kind for 2027. Baseball is making a comeback. The players are unbelievably talented. Ratings and attendance is going up. People are more interested in baseball now than they were, say, 5 years ago. So we can't have anything to get in that way. But right now, the two sides are not particularly close on a lot of things, and I'm worried, but I think a lot of people in the business are worried where this is going in a couple of years.
Like, I don't think the players' union would ever accept a salary cap, and I don't know if the owners would ever expect a salary floor, accept a salary floor. It does startle me, because I think for, like, in cities where sports are big, but it might not be the biggest one. Like, I think that because they don't have that, and Tim, you've heard this a million times, but I do. I think it's a killer. I think it's part of the reason we don't talk much baseball as much as we used to.
Well, you're right about the union. The union is not going to accept a salary cap, and ownership is going to have to recognize that, because this is what the union has been built on ever since Marvin Miller put everything together, and Tony Clark and his team is not going to go against what the union has done all these years. But we have to do something here to make the payroll disparity a little bit different. We have to do something with revenue sharing to help our smaller market teams. But these are huge questions that need to be answered. And right now, I'm just not sure there are enough answers this close to potential serious talks about labor.
It is the revenue pool. I know, you know, TV contract, the TV numbers are up. Seems like attendance is up. However, the local TV money is going down in everywhere except for like LA and New York. So what does that mean for the two sides fighting this out?
Yeah, well, the local TV packages aren't what they used to be, and those have to get figured out also. Easier said than done. Everything is easier said than done. So work has to be done there to help get more TV money for these teams, and then they can use that TV money hopefully in order to improve their teams and make things more competitive, because the difference right now between the really bad teams and the really good teams, as far as talent on the field goes, is the widest gap that I've ever seen in the 45 years that I've been covering. And it's just not healthy that the Rockies just lost their 70th game last night. It's not healthy that the White Sox were that bad last year and not a whole lot better this year. This needs to be changed to the point where the bad teams are more competitive and more teams move closer to the middle. But that's not happening anytime soon, and we got to work on that as an industry.
Find him on Twitter. Find him on ESPN. Find him on his podcast. Tim Kirkchin on the North Homestead Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. Tim, thank you so much for the time.
Thanks, fellas. See you.
But it was a good win for the Gardos last night. Angel Martinez with a massive grand slam to get the second straight win for the Gardos. And, whew, a little bit of time to breathe here. And to help us catch our breath with the Gardos, we head out to the North Homestead Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. And welcome on Al Pawlowski, Guardians TV host. Al Pal, welcome to the show, bud.
Hey, Nick. Hey, Jonathan. Great to be here with you fellas.
It's even better because we got two wins in a row here, so we can breathe a little bit. I know you're around the team. I know you've been around the team watching them try to navigate the last couple of weeks here. What do you think the last two games mean for this young team?
Well, I think it's definitely changed things around from just a mental perspective. When you start losing like they did, and losing in some of the ways they did. I mean, last week in Chicago, you know, you get beat 1-0 in 10 innings against Detroit. It seemed like, you know, you should have won all three of those games with the sort of pitching you got, but they just didn't have any offense at all. And then finally on Sunday, you get a lead late, two outs in the ninth inning, your closer's on the hill, and a ball squirts through your catcher, and they tie the game, and then they score a bunch of runs in the 10th inning, and you lose. So then, you know, it starts becoming where, and this is true of any sport, when you start losing and you're losing in some strange ways or crazy ways or games that you feel that normally you would win, then it becomes, oh my goodness, you know, how are we going to lose today? How is this going to happen? So when they finally got over that hump on Monday, it's like, okay, got that win, losing streak's over. And then yesterday, they found a way to win. And this is against a good Astros team on their home field who's also relaying the signals from second base to the batter. Now, I know it's legal, you can do that, but you've got a lot going on when you're playing in Houston. So to be able to win those two games, to put yourself in a position for a sweep today, the mental makeup of this team, I think, is in a much better spot than they were 48, 72 hours ago.
Yeah, Al Pal, do you think that people just overreacted over the previous, I don't know, 2 weeks or so?
Yes and no, you know, to be fair. Yeah, because this team was not as bad as that 10-game losing streak showed. I know that they're struggling to hit. There's no getting around that. especially the lower part of the order. That's all fair. But at the same time, you know, there is still talent here. And don't forget, at the end of the day, it's pitching that wins ball games at the end. Yes, you have to have offense too, of course. But when you look back at some of the really bad teams in baseball, the teams that you think aren't so bad, but for whatever reason they can't get to October, it's generally because of pitching. They don't have enough starting pitching. Their bullpen is bad. That's not the case here. I know the bullpen isn't as consistent as it was last year, but it's pretty good. The starters have been very good. So when you've got pitching, you're going to be in every game. You're eventually going to have some of these one-run games go your way, and that's what's happened now. So, you know, maybe a little bit of overreaction, but I can understand it. It's tough to watch your team lose day in, day out, and not get much offense.
Al, I bought early stock on Angel Martinez, and I've never sold it. Probably will never sell it. I'm of the young bats right now, especially the young guys that have struggled here off and on, who are you most confident will get it right and have a nice little run here in Cleveland?
Yeah, I like Angel Martinez a lot, too. I liked him when I first saw him when he was in the minor leagues. I liked him when he came up last year. I liked him when he came up this year. So I'm with you. I bought the stock, and I'm holding as well. I think that he's going to be probably that first one to become a consistent hitter. I don't think we're going to see grand slams out of him every night, but I think we're going to see a guy who is very capable of batting 300 at this level, who's occasionally going to give you some power, and who's versatile. Eventually, they might settle on one position with him, but you know he's got that versatility now, and he's so athletic. He can play in the outfield or the infield, so he's in a good spot, I think, for Cleveland. So that's the guy for me out of all these young hitters. You know, obviously there's some guys at AAA that have a lot of potential. I'm very interested to see how they react when they eventually get to the major league level. I think they've got some very good, you know, potential, more than just everyday players down there. They've got some guys that could be all-stars too. Now, of course, we have to see how it plays out. There's been a lot of potential all-stars that barely even made it to the majors and did anything, but I think they've got a couple of legit guys down there, maybe two or three right now at AAA. But of the guys up here, yeah, I think it's Martinez. Of all the young hitters, I also liked where Arias was going to. You know, he still wasn't the consistent player that you wanted before his injury, but he's starting to show signs. I thought every month he took another step forward with becoming that consistent sort of hitter too. So for me, Martinez and hopefully Arias when he gets back are the two young guys that I really like with the bats.
Austin Hedges got subbed in as a defensive replacement last night. Is there anything there? I mean, is there something there with Klasse and with Bo Naylor, or is it just they'll be fine and it just was a little bit of a mishap on Sunday and it was what it was?
I think it can be seen perhaps as a little bit of both. You know, when you lose a game like that on Sunday, that was deflating because you were ending the win streak against the best team in baseball who's in your division, who's one of your rivals, who you were good against this year in Detroit. You had that game. You felt like it. You've got what you feel is the best closer in the game on the mound, and he really didn't lose it. The ball got away, and that's what cost you. Now, it's going to be magnified, to be fair to Bo Naylor, when it's the 10th game in a row that you've lost. That's really going to be magnified. However, you know, yeah, I think that maybe Stephen Vogt's thinking was, okay, let's get Hedges out there for defense. We're pretty confident that the ball's not going to get by him, so Klasse can throw that ball with confidence. That's the other thing you've got to remember, too, as a pitcher. When you're throwing that breaking ball, whether it's a curveball, slider, splitter, cutter, whatever, you've got to be able with confidence to throw that ball so it's going to drop below the zone, probably bounce, because most of the time you're wanting swing and miss on that. You're not necessarily throwing your secondary pitches over the plate. You're not doing it a lot, at least. You want a lot of swing and miss, especially with two strikes. So you've got to make sure that who's ever on the mound has confidence. Now, that's Klasse, and I mean, he's got that cutter and a slider that are going to go in the dirt, and that he gets a lot of swing and miss there. So you want him to have the utmost confidence in his catcher that he's going to be able to make that stop.
Al Pawlowski, Guardians TV host on the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. I know we don't tend to get into, you know, trade deadline stuff with you there, but that was really interesting. Former MLB GM had linked the Tigers to Emmanuel Clase. So if we just take the names out of it and we just talk about the idea, do you think buyers, sellers, what have you, do you think the Tigers would be on a no-fly list for the Guardians in terms of in-season trades?
Most likely, as I think, you know, any division rivals are, and especially where Cleveland is at. So let's say they determine they need to be sellers at this trade deadline. I mean, they've got enough here in this organization, especially pitching-wise. I mean, next year they could bounce right back and be competing for first place again. Who knows? I mean, if things pick up, look at Detroit last year. They were left dead in the water at the trade deadline, and they made an incredible run the last couple of months. And they also got some very good pitching at the end of last year, too, which helped make that run. So anything can happen. That's why I don't think you're going to give up somebody like Class A to the Tigers. It would just be too difficult to deal with, because you don't just give up a guy who you know is probably going to be successful wherever he goes. He's in the prime of his career. Now, if you can get the right package for him, you know, as many GMs will tell you, anybody is available. I'll listen to anything if somebody wants to overspend. Remember at the time when they traded Mike Clevinger, and people are like, well, why are they trading Mike Clevinger? Well, clearly they got an incredible return for him, and also they traded him at the exact right time. You know, if somebody comes forward with a great offer for Class A, I could see that move being made. However, I just find it extremely unlikely it happens within the division. That being said, if the Tigers come and just absolutely blow them out of the water to where they can't say no, well, as the saying goes, you can't say no.
Yeah, Al, that's my thinking, is like if they throw Max Clark in there or someone like that, and it's just like that's exactly the type of player that the Guardians could use and would need. If that cost you Class A, and yes, it would make the Tigers better in the moment, but if that's what that is, then I don't know why it should be a no-go.
Yeah, it's you know, you never say never. So that's a great point you make, John. And believe me, this front office is very good at evaluating other organizations and what they have and what would fit within Cleveland's organization. So they're never going to say never. However, if they're going to trade Class A to a divisional rival, it would have to be an overwhelming package. But that could happen. I mean, it's happened in the past. It's never like division rivals haven't made trades with one another. It's just rarer than, say, making a trade with, like, the National League West, where Cleveland, you know, has made a lot of trades in the past, especially the Padres.
Al, we, you know, one of the big things we always talk about is sample size and not putting too much pressure on certain segments of the season. But yet, the trade deadline looms there. You've just won two after losing 10 straight. You got, five games before the All-Star break. How important are the next five games for this team just to continue things in a positive direction?
Yeah, if they're going to be buyers at the deadline, I would say that this trend now has to continue, because the 10-game losing streak did put them in a fairly significant hole as far as getting a playoff spot. The chances of anybody but the Tigers winning the Central right now is very slim. When you take a look at the lead they have at this point in the season, historically, they're going to be incredibly hard to catch, and probably nobody in this division catches them. So, okay, you got to look at the wild card. Now, with the extra team that was added recently, you know, there's a lot more teams that have a chance that didn't necessarily have one, let's say, 5, 10, 15 years ago. So you've got a shot with these extra wild cards now. So can they win the next few and get it to within a reasonable distance? Because the wild card deficit is always harder to overcome than a divisional deficit, simply because you're competing against the entire league as opposed to just five teams, or I should say four teams within your division. So if you have to run down one team or two teams and you're within six or seven at the All-Star break, very doable. But if you're within six or seven of a wild card spot and you're competing with eight other teams legitimately for those spots, then it's awfully difficult, because other teams are going to get hot as well. So they're going to have to win a number of games in a row, or go on a nice run of, you know, winning 6 out of 8 or 8 out of 10 to now start to think like, okay, maybe we are still in this thing. And then don't dismiss something like Detroit did last year, where they traded Flaherty, got what they wanted, go back and re-sign Flaherty. They might make a trade that at the moment looks like they're sellers, but the people they're getting back, or the spaces that are created opening-wise, actually could make them a better team in the second half. You guys kind of understand what I'm saying? That you could still make a trade of a veteran, but in some ways that might make you a better team because of what that trade does for perhaps opening a spot.
Will Wilson got the at-bat for Nolan Jones, who had two hits in the game last night. Jonathan Rodriguez got the at-bat for Schneeman as well. And it just feels like late in these games, I understand what they're going for with the platooning, but you feel like they maybe go to that well just a little bit too much, and maybe they should ride guys like Nolan Jones, who are having successful days at the plate, a little bit longer.
Yeah, Jones has gotten a little bit better, but I'll say this. Nobody on this team outside of Jose Ramirez, Stephen Kwan, and Carlos Santana that are healthy at the moment have proven themselves as everyday players, to be fair. So they're going to, you know, Stephen Vogt and the Guardians, they're going to take a look and say, okay, where can we get the best matchup here? So if Kwan's up, it doesn't matter who's on the mound. Kwan's batting. Jose Ramirez, same thing. Carlos Santana, same thing. But if it's just about anybody else, they're going to go with the matchups and what they say on paper until somebody can step forward and become consistent. And I agree with you, Jones. I mean, he had a pretty good month of June. He's you can see the progress in July. He's now in the starting lineup sometimes against lefties, so he's getting that opportunity. So if he proves himself as an everyday player, they're not going to pinch hit for him. But, you know, if he's still making outs, if that average is still low, if the contact is not where you want it, then they're going to go ahead and PH for him.
Al, great stuff, man. Excited after the last 2 days. Can't wait to see where the Guardians take this before the All-Star break. But you're always so generous with your time, and we appreciate it, sir.
Thanks, Al.
You got it, fellas. Good talking to you. Take care.
You too, bud. Al Pawlowski there, Guardians TV host on the North Homestead Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. We will react to what he had to say, and we do have to react to an unfortunate set of circumstances in decisions by Stephen Vogt and the reality that comes with that in 5 minutes on 92.3 The Fan.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Greene from the Commercial Break Podcast. It's likely you've heard of the show if you're directly related to me or you follow our MySpace page. But I'm not here to talk to those three listeners. I'm here to appeal to people who haven't heard the show. Along with my co-host, Kristen Joy Hoadley, we're taking a deeper look at the topics that are affecting our youth today. Like, who are the people who are dating ghosts? Where did all these pickup artists come from? And why doesn't my preacher have a nicer private jet? We understand that these are the issues you really want to get to the bottom of. The Commercial Break is now available on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.